This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with John McBean and Brandon Peterson from Kit Fox Aircraft about kit-built airplanes. In the news, we look at a digital co-pilot for GA, the gigantic Strato launch airplane, Middle Eastern Airlines Shun Cutter, an aviation-themed playground, the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force wants mandatory budget caps removed, and President Trump wants the U.S. air traffic control system privatized. We also have a very informative listener recording about pulling through and hand-propping radial engines. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 455 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined first by, well, the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI author, glass cockpit expert, and he hosts the Aviation News Talk Podcast. Hi, Max. How are you?
Max, I am awesome. I just wanted to say I'm happy to actually be in town. I'm starting to imitate Brian with traveling all the time. So you caught me on a day when I'm in town this week, so that's good.
Excellent. Speaking of Brian, that's Brian Coleman. He's also with us, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Max and Max, and good evening, everyone. And I'm really excited that maybe soon I won't be in town because United started new nonstop service to Singapore from LAX.
Oh,
and they're doing coach fares for $706.
You're kidding.
Round trip? Which I thought was round trip, which is really cheap.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and business class fares are $4,198. And the important upgradable fare was $1,159.
Wow. So you said this was United?
Yeah. And they're starting service October 27th from Los Angeles to compete with the service they're already doing from San Francisco. So they're going to be the most, they'll have the most flights from California to Singapore, nonstop.
Nice. And Singapore is such a really fantastic destination, too. I used to go there quite often on business, and I miss that. Very good. All right, let's see. Who else is around? Oh, David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. David, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm fine. We're all fine here. Let's get started.
Okay, well, this episode, we have two guests from Kit Fox Aircraft. Now, a little background. The original Kit Fox Model 1 was introduced at Oshkosh Air Venture in 1984. The modern Kit Fox has stayed true to the concept of the original design. It's fun, it's comfortable, it's an affordable airplane, and it can be easily built without any special tools or training. Today, Kit Fox Aircraft is owned and operated by John and Deborah McBean from their Homedale Municipal Airport. Actually, it's not their Homedale Municipal Airport, but the Homedale Municipal Airport in southwest Idaho. The McBeans were builders before they owned the company, and they often helped other builders with their projects. John holds commercial and instructor ratings. He comes from a family with a long history of flying. So we'd like to welcome John McBean to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Hello, John.
Hello, Max. Thank you.
Also with us from Kit Fox is Brandon Peterson. Now, he joined the team in 2012 as the wing builder, and his role has evolved over time. You can find his fingerprints on the company's social media posts, videos, wings, fiberglass products that are shipped to builders around the world. Now, after starting to work there, Brandon quickly figured out that there's just no way to work around all these great airplanes every day and not fly them. So in 2013, he received his private pilot certificate. He attended a number of events, but Brandon realized his lifelong dream of flying into Oshkosh for Air Venture in 2013, and he's been back every year since. So, Brandon, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you, Max. Hello, everyone.
Is it really true that you guys play the Airplane Geeks podcasts in the shop?
That is an actual fact, yes. Every week in the wing shop, we play it over a Bluetooth speaker and everybody can hear it.
Wow. I'm impressed.
That's what's kind of weird is I'm hearing the voices in my head in real time, and it's actually star striking a little bit.
Here we are. Well, listen, to all you folks.
Oh, I'm so sorry for you.
Yeah. After this show, they'll probably turn it off, never listen to us.
Yeah, again. I was going to say that takes care of that episode for the week.
All right. Well, we're going to launch into the news first before we have our focused conversation with John and Brandon. So I'll ask, is everyone ready for the news?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story comes from Aviation Today. This is, could general aviation use a digital co-pilot? This is from MITRE Corporation. They have some researchers in their Center for Advanced Aviation System Development, and they've developed what they call a digital co-pilot. The concept here is that general aviation single-pilot flight operations would benefit from a tablet app that monitors and communicates safety-critical flight information to the pilot. Max T., maybe we can start with you. Does this sound like a product that would fill an important role?
Yeah, I was just trying to turn that around in my mind. You know, all their trade-offs with any new product, new idea. And I suspect that this might be a little bit more helpful for folks who are in less automated cockpits. You know, so for example, if they're in an airplane that doesn't have a lot of automation, that it might be more helpful for those folks. I spend most of my time in glass cockpit type aircraft, and a lot of the pilots are carrying ForeFlight, which does some of these things already. And so I would say, yeah, it's probably going to be more useful for folks in older round gauge aircraft. That's just kind of my guess.
The concept is kind of interesting to me in that it's not just another passive display, I'll call it, for the pilot, that they're looking at voice activation, speech recognition, and all that, and as a way for the pilot to communicate with, you know, the device and for the device to communicate back to the pilot. Another interesting part about this is the algorithms that are designed to look at the current situation, what the pilot is doing, what they're trying to do, so that this digital co-pilot can monitor progress against what the plan was and try to help out. John, what are your thoughts on this?
I get very nervous about anything regarding too much automation. Monitoring is always good, but when you get into automation specifically towards, and it's a hard question to answer until you actually experience it probably, but what are they looking for in that co-pilot? Just to interact? Are they looking, what type of co-pilot information are they looking for?
I think that some of the things besides just sort of, you know, verbal reminders that the pilot might enjoy, things like air traffic communication frequencies, current weather conditions, maybe even runway information, things like that. They also say that pilots could request customized reminders. And I also understand that MITRE isn't necessarily looking to produce a product themselves, but more looking towards offering these proprietary algorithms to others, to tablet-based aviation app makers, so that they could incorporate them into the applications that are already used by the pilots. But I think that this is the sort of thing where you'd really like to see it first, have a real good in-depth review of just what this is, what it's intended to do, and how it operates.
Well, I think an automated co-pilot can be very handy. In essence, a simple autopilot is almost a function of a second pilot command, especially when you're in IFR conditions. So this could be a very handy thing, but it can also be, you get into the recreational side of flying, and those things can be almost distracting to some point and take some of the recreation out of that flight.
John, I totally agree. I was sitting here thinking, if I had money to spend, I'd much rather spend it on a low-cost autopilot than on a, you know, a tablet that is talking to me and giving me information. I think the Autopilot is probably going to be more expensive, but I think pilots would get better value out of it when you look at the kinds of loss of control accidents that they encounter. You know, the tablet's not going to save them from inadvertent IMC into a cloud, but an Autopilot definitely could. So, yeah, I'm on the same page with you. I'd vote for the Autopilot before this.
Trescott, stop using acronyms that us civilians don't understand.
Yeah, I realize as I said that. IMC.
Yeah, what I was about to say is the Safe Taxi that Garmin has, ForeFlight has it as well. When you're approaching things, that's kind of what they're enhancing, it sounds like. And I don't know if anybody experienced that. When you taxi up to a runway, it tells you that you're entering that active runway. It kind of gives you those voice alerts through the Garmin Safe Taxi or through ForeFlight.
Yeah, and I was surprised. I used ForeFlight on a trip last week and had just downloaded the latest version, and it was telling me midway along, you know, what the ATIS was for the destination. That was actually popping up on the screen. So yeah, that sounds like some of the same kinds of things. And when I said IMC, I mentally blanked on the I. It's instrument meteorological conditions. kind of embarrassed I couldn't remember what the I was, but, you know, I
see,
just say the
acronym.
See,
that's why I don't want you to use acronyms.
Okay. All especially right. When I can't remember what they are.
All right. Well, let's move away from little short acronyms, small things, and talk about something really, really big. And this is the Strato launch aircraft. Have a item here from NBC, the Bay Area NBC.com. And this is the gigantic Strato launch aircraft emerges from its hangar in the California desert. Now, I think we might have talked about this way back when the idea was first being developed, but the Strato launch is a twin fuselage aircraft with a 385-foot wingspan. You can imagine that. And it's designed to carry a launch vehicle as part of an air launch to orbit system. So the launch vehicle would be sort of cradled or suspended between these two fuselages, carried up, after which it would be boosted into a low Earth orbit. Well, this company that's now called Strato Launch Systems Corporation, it was officially announced back in 2011 by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and at the time Scaled Composites founder Bert Rutan. They have a goal of going commercial with this by 2020. The article, and we'll have the link to this, of course, in the show notes, has a lot of really great photographs of this thing. And it is enormous. This is a large, large airplane. What do you guys think about this concept?
It's really great concept. One of the things that I'm curious about, and I'm so glad that there are some engineers on the show that have built airplanes before, and especially one that I guess the wing can hold on with a single pin. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. With these two fuselages and three engines on each side, it sure doesn't look like there's much holding the two fuselages together. And I was just thinking in an engine out condition or some sort of situation where the thrust would be off balance. I mean, what's the likelihood of this thing ripping apart in air?
Well, I would say slim.
Never let it be said Brian is just the optimistic person of all. God, all those United flights have really torn you down, haven't they?
But look at that thing. There's not much holding it together.
Oh, I suspect that carry-through spar is probably pretty substantial that connects the two at the fuselage. But what do you guys think up there, Kit Fox?
The asymmetrical thrust would be unwilling as far as that's concerned. But with your twin booms and the way that's designed, you're not going to have a problem with that at all. That's a complete trust boom going across their own.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I sort of had the same reaction that Brian had. It does have kind
Thank
of a
you,
fragile
Max.
Look to it, you know, when you think about the forces that could be involved or with weather or something. So, plus, I mean, this is coming from, you know, the Scaled Composites people. I mean, they have more than a little bit of experience with different kinds of configurations. So I feel better now.
You guys do understand that the rocket goes between the fuselages.
Yes, yes.
So if you're going to hang something off of that, that's going to be an extra strong wing to hang a large rocket off of it. Brian, your scenario about the wing ripping off, it will be a lot of torque to rip that wing off, especially if they're going to be dropping rockets from it.
Yeah, good to know.
Yeah, and I think that would...
makes me feel a lot better.
I think the only source of that would probably be a thunderstorm or something violent in the air that would have the force to do that. I don't think under any kind of normal conditions or engine out conditions you'd see it. But I think economically it's a heck of a concept. I have read years ago that the most expensive part of a satellite launch is getting up through that first 50,000-60,000 feet. You burn just a tremendous amount of fuel. So this looks like they found a cost efficient way to get the satellite up through that initial thick, dense atmosphere, and then they could just launch it from there inexpensively. So the other nice thing is they probably don't have to fly it every day, which means if the weather's lousy, who cares if your satellite goes up next week instead of this week?
Yeah.
Well, like any launch, any satellite launch, it's always weather dependent anyway.
Right.
So they would be picking ideal weather conditions to launch, I would assume.
I'm impressed by the hangar. Isn't that interesting? That's a custom hangar. I mean, that thing is built to the shape of the airplane.
Right. Yeah, they built that first before the airplane. But they did use a couple of 747-400s for parts. The engines are from the 747, so that's six Pratt & Whitney PW4000 engines. They also used from the two 747s they acquired, the avionics, flight deck, and I guess some of the landing gear, or the landing gear, not some of it, the landing gear from the 747s as well. It's really fascinating. I really can't wait to 2020 to see this thing used in operation. We're just seeing so many, I don't know, it's like we're in this new era of aviation or aerospace these days with SpaceX and this and all the things that are going on. It's exciting times.
And what do you think caused that inflection point? I mean, what change in technology has brought this kind of rapid change where now we're suddenly seeing far more unusual designs that are very capable that we haven't seen in the past?
I think it's the new class of billionaires.
Okay.
I think it's, and this is just speculation, but I mean, what you're asking, Max, is a really, really good question. But to me, it's, you've got these guys who have, more money than God plus Oprah combined. And, they have dreams and they, they're able to use the financial resources they have to try to fulfill these dreams. But that's just a theory.
What's one of the things I think is interesting about those pictures too, when you look at it and then look at the name of it, I can't help to think that they didn't model some of those things after the B-52, which was the Stratofortress. Which it's interesting if you look at the images of the nose and all that, it kind of has a reminiscent of that B-52.
Yeah, yes, it does. It does, doesn't it?
And the original prototype used two B-52 fuselages. What's the original concept for it?
That's what I remember. Did they actually build that, David? Or was that just that was the concept?
That was the original concept.
Yeah, that's what I remember, using two 747 fuselages. So, yeah, I guess they've gone a little bit of a different route. All right, speaking of routes, the Middle East, this has kind of popped up. We have an article from CNN, Mideast Airlines halt Qatar flights as Gulf crisis escalates. More drama from the Middle East. Well, actually, drama is probably not a very good word because this is pretty serious. What we have here is Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and Egypt have accused Qatar of supporting terrorism, and they've broken off relations with that country. So as a result, Etihad, Emirates, Fly Dubai, and Gulf Air are discontinuing flights in and out of Doha, the capital of Qatar.
And not only did they discontinue flights, but overflight rights have been removed.
Yeah, that's right. Saudi Arabia's banned Qatar from flying into the kingdom. UAE said they're closing its airspace to Qatar. Now, of course, the Qatari, I guess you say Qatari, the government called this, quote, unjustified and based on baseless allegations. But I think this will play out a little bit. This is, pretty disruptive. We're talking about some major airlines here that carry significant volumes of traffic. So, this is going to have a big impact, I think.
Well, and in addition, not being able to fly over Saudi Arabia or the UAE, these planes are going to have to go a long way out of the way to get to their destination if they're flying west.
Yeah.
Or south.
All right, something maybe a little more fun. This came, let's see, David, did we find this in our Slack listener team? This is from...
I believe so.
Yeah, I think so. This is the aviation-themed playground coming to Stafford Airport. That's in Virginia, Stafford Regional Airport. They're building a playground around an aviation theme. It's got little miniature runways and taxiways, and kids will be able to fly their little pedal airplanes down the runways. It's going to have a control tower with scopes for plane spotting, and what a great way to help involve small children in sort of aviation topics. I really like this idea.
I think it's fabulous. Trying to get the younger generation involved and engaged in aviation is getting more difficult, especially with the security restrictions today that we have. You know, as a young child, I get up into the cockpit of the United Airlines or the American Airlines cab while you were in flight, and it was just remarkable. And we don't have those same options today, and trying to get the younger generation involved is difficult from a pilot's perspective. So I think these are awesome to see this.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's an age limit.
I hope not.
Brian, you're probably going to go to see some kids because you're hoping that prevent some kid from scraping his knee on the runway.
Now, there's two nonprofits that are involved in making this happen, EAA Chapter 1099 and also the Rappahannock Aviation Outreach, it's called. That's a nonprofit organization based in Stafford, Virginia. They say they're focused on community outreach programs and initiatives that educate and inspire youth in aviation. So besides the link to the article, we'll have a link to the Rappahannock Aviation Outreach Organization. Sounds like a great group. Yeah, this is doing great stuff.
And it looks like you could purchase bricks and have your names put on them.
Oh, then that's a great idea. You know, we're always looking for charitable organizations that we can support those involved in aviation. And yeah, maybe this is another one to consider. Well, moving on to military. DefenseNews.com says new Air Force head calls for end to defense budget caps. Now, Dr. Heather Wilson, who was actually the first female military veteran elected to a full term in Congress. But more recently, the U.S. Senate confirmed her nomination as U.S. Secretary of the Air Force. That just occurred last month, about a month ago, on May 8th, 2017. Wilson has now asked Congress to remove the mandatory budget caps of the Budget Control Act. David, what does that mean?
The Budget Control Act was commonly known as sequester, that the U.S., the Pentagon had to have decreases in spending over, it's been 5 or 6 years now. And they have major caps on their defense spending. So the Air Force wanted to purchase 60 F-35s. They only bought 45. Likewise, there's other mission systems. And it was all part of budget cutting during the Obama administration. And they were struggling with manpower issues and reductions of costs and base closures, et cetera. And now SECAF wants to remove those caps so they can make the purchases they need. A lot of this has to do with things like infrastructure. They have, We talk about transportation infrastructure in the civilian world, but in the military world, also due to budget cuts, things like housing and facilities like hangars and runways, as well as weapon systems, the whole infrastructure has been dramatically reduced due to try to find cost savings. So the SECAF wants to release those so they can start funding projects. A lot of them are infrastructure projects. You know, when we were out at Pittsburgh, Max, and they were talking about transferring the mission from C-130s to C-17s,
it's not just the airplanes. That whole base is going to have to be rebuilt. The hangars can't handle C-17s, so they're going to need bigger hangars. They're going to need new fuel facilities. They're going to need jet maintenance stands instead of turboprop maintenance stands. And all that stuff costs money. So any of those kind of transitions, they had to find a budget for. And it's been one of those, well, if I can't have that and I need this, I need to cut something else. And the other big announcement came from it was there's going to be new sizable bonuses for people to stay in the Air Force as pilots, because the Air Force, like the rest of the world, is coming upon a severe pilot shortage.
Hmm. And if you keep them in the Air Force, then they're not available to move into the commercial aviation sector. So that maybe compounds the problem for commercial aviation.
Exactly. But the problem with tours of duties, et cetera, it's not been conducive for people to stay in. And we've reduced the amount of Air National Guard and Air Force Reserve units. So to fund primarily the main Air Force. So we don't have that core of individual pilots also. So the SECAF and the Secretary of the Navy, and I'm sure the Secretary of the Army, are all going to be chafing at the bit for money in this current administration. Whether they get it or not, I don't know.
Right. Hey, Congress has to take action in order for that to happen. All right, one more item, and this is concerning privatization of air traffic control in the U.S. And I think, as most people know, President Trump has been sort of advocating that, hinting around that. This is the week where he's making a number of declarations, or he's talking about infrastructure, and he addressed this issue. He's urging Congress to privatize air traffic control, and we have this.
At its core, our new plan will dramatically improve America's air traffic control system by turning it over to a self-financing nonprofit organization. This new entity will not need taxpayer money, which is very shocking when people hear that. They don't hear that too often. Under this new plan, the Federal Aviation Administration will focus firmly on what it does best, safety. A separate nonprofit entity would be charged with ensuring route efficiency, timely service, and a long-awaited reduction in delays. Our plan will also maintain support for rural communities and small airports, including airfields used by our Air National Guard units, great people. And very importantly, air traffic controllers will highly valued. These are highly valued people. These are amazing people that know this system so well. And under our plan, they will have more financial security, professional opportunity, and far superior equipment, the best equipment anywhere in the world. There'll never be anything like what we're doing. And other systems are very good. I won't tell you the names of the country, but we have studied numerous countries, one in particular. They have a very, very good system. Ours is going to top it by a lot. Our incredible air traffic controllers keep us safe every day, even though they are forced to use this badly outdated system. That is why we want to give them access to capital markets and investors so they can obtain the best, newest, and safest technology available. And by the way, the new technology, and I've seen it, is incredible. If we adopt these changes, Americans can look forward to cheaper, faster, and safer travel, a future where 20% of a ticket price doesn't go to the government, and where you don't have to sit on a tarmac or circle for hours and hours over an airport, which is very dangerous. Also, before you land, dozens of countries have already made similar changes with terrific results, and we're going to top them actually by a long shot. Canada, as an example, modernized their air.
All right, and it continues on for a little bit. If you want to hear the entire statement, check out our show notes, airplanegeeks.com/455, and you'll find a link to that video.
And somebody just said the new program is all directions from air traffic controllers will be in 140 characters or less.
Oh, here we go. That's cute, Twitter.
Well, since that came out today, the Alphabet groups, almost all of them have come out and voiced their opposition to privatization of air traffic control. And when I say Alphabet groups, I'm talking about the general aviation groups especially, which is kind of the script that we expected.
Well, we've had a lot of time to prepare for this. This proposal goes back originally to, I believe, the 1990s, back during the Clinton years when it was first proposed. And it seems like every administration, regardless of party, brings it up at some point in time. The good news is Congress has been consistently opposed to it over the last 20 years. So that's a really good thing. The really bad thing about this proposal is that they specifically said that they would do away with the fuel tax, which is what the airlines have been trying to do, and they would replace that with user fees. A year ago, when the proposal last kind of floated, it was said at that time that no, there would not be user fees for general aviation. And AOPA has said that they would oppose privatization if there were user fees. Well, now that there are, it'll be interesting to see if they're finally on board with opposing privatization.
What's interesting is they cite examples of what they've evaluated. And if any of you have flown in Europe, you'll find that recreational aviation and general aviation is stifled heavily because of user fees. So it's something we have to be very, very cautious of. I can see some benefit to privatization, but overall, I think it's probably a bad plan. What we have works. We just need to make it better.
I want to know, with his saying that privatizing it will make the employees more secure, I'd really like to know how any company that has more secure employees than federal government employees. That one just befuddles me.
Yeah, there's a lot about this, which, when you start to peel back the onion, you kind of go, really? Huh? I mean, we've got the largest, safest, and I would say best run air traffic control system in the world. And sure, anything can be improved, but it's not broken. And I think the mantra we keep hearing is, oh, it's on the edge of disaster. It's terrible. It's about to, fall apart. We have to do something. Well, I call BS on that. I do not believe that's the case.
And of course, especially for those of you not in the U.S., this is not a done deal by any means. What has to happen is Congress has to act in order to make any changes like this. And yeah, it's unclear how that is going to go. There's certainly a number of Congress people that are in favor of privatization of air traffic control, but there's also some that are not so convinced. And there's also the issue of how do you transfer assets, government-owned assets, to a private corporation, and how would all that work? And do you really want to give all that away? It'll get very complicated. So I think we can look forward to some long debates over this in Congress, and of course the groups that represent aviation interests on both sides will be very, very active on this topic.
May you GA geeks suffer like I've suffered with tankers with this.
You mean the never-ending story, huh?
Yes.
You got your tankers. Now it's our turn. We want to keep ATC the way it is. The timeline of this, I think, is going to be when the FAA reauthorization bill comes due sometime in September. So I think this is going to be a fairly heated topic over the next few months, though Congress does have, I believe it's a 7-week break that comes up over August. So we may hear a lot about this over the next 5-6 weeks, and then not much, and then it'll get crazy again in September. But I am sure that there will come a time when we and the other Alphabet groups will be imploring our listeners to write letters to the Congress people, because that's, I think, the only thing that's going to stop this.
All right, let's talk about KitFox. Again, we're with John McBean and Brandon Peterson from KitFox aircraft. Let's jump right in. You guys are looking at bringing the Kitfox Speedster to Oshkosh this year. What is this Speedster? Tell us about it.
Well, historically, back in the early 90s, there was a Model 4 Speedster that was became a very popular. It's a clipped wing version of the Kitfox Model 4. What made it really known is a pilot by the name of Jimmy Franklin, who flew an aerobatic routine at Oshkosh back in 1992. This was a stock Kitfox Model 4. Became very popular, just fared up, very clean, and kind of a nostalgic look. What we've done is fast forward from 92 to 2017, however many years that is now, and we introduced the Series 7 Speedster, which is going to make its debut at Oshkosh this year. It's bigger, faster, larger payload, higher gross weights. I just said the same thing, but higher gross weights, larger payload, larger baggage area, just all the way around a different airplane, more aggressive airplane, more in tune with the new logo that we introduced. It's just kind of a new image. And it's, a clipped wing. Ironically enough, a young boy that was 13 years old at the time when Jimmy was flying it, watched the routine and enjoyed it so much. And that boy was Kyle Franklin, who is Jimmy Franklin's son. We're arranging with Kyle currently to fly the routine at Oshkosh as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. You've got a paint scheme, a Jason Knoll paint scheme?
The paint scheme was designed by Jason Knoll of Dream Scheme Designs, and it's kind of a retro look back to the original scallop that we had on the original Speedster. And I forget there's no visual cues on a podcast, so I have to remember that. and the scallop goes back into the kind of the 30s retro scheme. Well, we've kind of got more a little more aggressive to that. It doesn't have round, smooth scallops, more pointed scallops. It's an aggressive look. It's going to be exciting and get people's attention.
Brendan, what kind of people are attracted to Kitfox aircraft? Is there a type of pilot that you can describe, or is it kind of across the board?
It's a lot across the board, but usually it's a very discerning pilot, somebody that wants their airplane to be practical, somebody that doesn't want to spend a bunch of time bucking rivets, and you know they want to feel like that project is moving along. There are people that like to fly every weekend, get out with their friends, you know, go have breakfast, do the short runs, do the long runs. You know, the Kitfox itself is pretty versatile, so we see a lot of people using it in a lot of different ways. Specifically, the Speedster, we hope to target a little younger audience. It's got some sharper lines to it. It's crisp, it's clean, it's fast. The standard Kitfox, the Series 7 Super Sport, is a very, very good STOL type airplane. And shortening that wing has given us a little more top-end speed without having to give up a whole lot of that STOL performance. And so it's kind of a little bit of that best of both worlds that we're trying to cater to that little younger pilot who sees the slick, fast plastic airplanes and thinks that's what they need.
Mm-hmm. And Brendan, when you talk about speed, what speed are you? Is this aircraft doing?
The Speedster will very easily hit the VNE of the aircraft, which is about 140 miles an hour.
Now, before we started the recording, I think it was David. Wasn't it you, David, that said that you'd always wanted to build a Kitfox?
Yeah, believe it or not, this geek actually likes airplanes, not just military airplanes. And from years of reading Air Progress, I've always thought the Kitfox was really cool. And especially when you throw very large Tundra tires on it. It's such a cool STOL aircraft. It would have been one of my top choices for a kit build.
Hey, David, you know, you ought to come up and experience stick and rudder aviation. They're a flight school that specializes in backcountry training, has two Kitfoxes with big tires and everything else to go back there and enjoy some of what Idaho has to offer.
Hmm. Well, what kind of skills does it take to put these together? I mean, David has historian skills, research skills, but I don't know if he's handy with a wrench or not, but what would David have to be capable of?
I build plastic models for a hobby.
Is that close enough?
And radio control.
Yeah, it's a different type of glue. That's all, you know. basically, you know, the way we've set up the program is a manual that's easy to follow. All the hard stuff in the airplane is done for you so that you don't have to be a welder to be able to build this airplane. All the welding assemblies are done for you. If you look at the wing construction, it's very, very simple. Follow the steps. You know, a lot of drilling and riveting and that sort of thing in the wing, and then gluing the ribs onto the spars. You know, there's attention to detail items, and if you have an attention to detail, you can build this airplane very easily.
And if you're not interested in building it yourself, you can actually have it built in the factory, correct?
Yes, we actually introduced a factory-built SLSA Special Light Sport Aircraft in 2009. And currently, we can't keep up with demand. We have about a year and a half backlog.
Wow. See, that'd be the one for me.
Turn the key and go fly.
Brandon, tell us about the wing shop. What does that involve? What's the process? I'm imagining some, you know, big fixtures and jigs and things. Is that what's happening in the wing shop?
We have a couple of wing fixtures. The customer can build a wing themselves if they want, but about 95% of our clients and builders buy the quick build option. So it's factory built. It's assembled in a fixture that looks like a torture device if you don't see a wing in it. basically, that just assures the alignment and the twist of the wing is proper when it gets to the client's home. We have a CNC table router there, a 4x8 table router, where we cut all of our own wood parts, our plastic parts, a handful of aluminum parts that go in the airplane, all cut on that. And our flaperons are actually built in the wing shop also, and they're a skinned foam with a aluminum spar.
What kind of tolerances are we typically talking about with kit aircraft like this? I mean, I come, obviously, as people know, from the jet engine manufacturing side, so we have some pretty tight tolerances on many parts. I'm sure it's not the same here, but what kind of tolerances are there in the assembly process, or is a customer putting one of these together? What are the tolerances like? What are the risks of being out of spec, as it were, out of tolerance?
You're getting into a safety, kind of a safety item there. And ironically enough, we have a tremendous safety record with the airplane because of how it's structured. You're not building structure. You're assembling a product. When you talk about tolerances, a classic joke is you cut it to shape, hammer to fit, and paint it to match, and off you go. And that sounds remarkably simple, but it is almost that way. And I don't want to underplay it because there is attention to detail, the aluminum spars. There's components within it that are, you want to say fragile, that are, you don't want to scratch heavily or gouge. And if you do, you actually scrap the part. And we have tolerance that are clearly displayed for that. And that's one of the things, when you're looking in the general aviation or you're looking in the experimental kit world, you want to be very sensitive to what kind of support is coming from the factory side of that, that enables you to understand what those tolerances can be, and are you building structure? So I've kind of segued into something else here that will, a lot of airplanes, you are building structure. You're putting bulkheads together. You're putting the ribs together. The ribs create the wing structure. The skin creates the wing structure. Whereas with the Kitfox, the wing, for example, the spars, the inserts, the ribs are pre-done for you. And if you order the quick build wing, you are essentially assembling that structure. The fuselage is welded. There's no welding required by you. So again, that structure, when you put the fabric on it, you're creating the aesthetic look and the airflow on the outside of it. So the structure itself is already done for you.
Ah, so you've really done the hard part, or the safety critical parts for the purchaser.
Well, I'd like to think so, yes. And we're always trying to reach to get better and better at it.
What's an average build time like?
Average build time across the board we see for first-time builders with full-time jobs and family usually averages around 18 months or 1,000 hours.
Huh. Max D, do you run across many people who've got home built?
You know, it's a significant portion of the fleet out there. I would say that probably at the large kind of almost metro airport that I'm at, probably it's fewer of them percentage-wise that are in the fleet as a whole. My guess, and you guys would have to confirm this for me, is that a lot of owners tend to be at smaller, more rural airports. But I'm not sure. What have you guys found?
Oh, I think you'll see them more at rural areas, private airstrips. The experimental movement is the fastest single growing segment in aviation. I know we personally have well over 6,000 kits sold worldwide, and Vans is the number one seller of those, and I think they're over 10,000 now of kits. I don't know how those kits are assembled. They sell a tail kit, for example, in sub-assemblies, whereas ours are more of a fuselage kit or a complete firewall back kit.
Are you seeing trends in the kit built industry in terms of, interest or demographics of the customers? What's the outlook?
The outlook is fabulous. Again, being the fastest growing segment of the aviation world, and because it is more of the recreational, you hear a lot on the STOL side of the house right now. Our business has been doing very well. The basic med that was just introduced is going to be a boon for aviation in general, I feel. It has its downfalls, which can be discussed at a later date probably, but I think that's going to help general aviation overall, and it's going to help us in the kit industry overall, because the technology that's out there in a FAR Part 23 certified airplane is old. It's not getting any newer. In the experimental world, you can advance into some of this newer technology, which is it's enjoyable, it's fun, and it's also going to appeal to that younger demographic that we want to bring into our circle. The health of general aviation, which is what started the conversation, for us, it's very good. As I mentioned, we have about a year and a half backlog on our factory-built turnkeys. We do 4 to 10 kits a month, and we have about a 90-day backlog on our kits right now. So I think it's very good. The light sport movement, a lot of people think the basic med's going to remove the light sport segment, and I'm not sure that's true. I think in the beginning, you'll see something slow down a little bit. Long term, I think light sport's going to stay just as popular as it is today. Kit Fox has been around for 33 years this year. We've been building sport aircraft for 33 years. They just didn't call them light sport aircraft. So whether you're operating on a private pilot certificate or a commercial pilot certificate or a light sport certificate, the Kit Fox can fit that bill. And I didn't want that to come off like a commercial, believe it or not, but that's what experimental aviation is all about, where a Cessna 150 is a Cessna 150. Great airplane. I can only hope to be that popular. But it is a FAR Part 23 certified airplane that fits a specific mission, and that's all it can do. The technology is there to allow that airplane to do a lot more, but because it's FAR Part 23, you can't advance it. So in comes other airplanes to fill that niche.
And John, what about the location of your customers? Do you have many sales outside of the U.S., or is this predominantly U.S. Acquired aircraft?
Oh, no, that we're selling them all over the world. We've sold them to 42 different countries. We just shipped one to Thailand. Another one's going to Austria here shortly. We sell literally all over the world.
Do people buy them because they want to build their own, or are they primarily motivated by trying to save money? What's sort of the balance of those two factors?
I think there's a lot of accomplishment in building your own airplane and flying it. But one of the benefits is when you get done with it, you have a brand new airplane.
Yeah.
For someone to go out and buy something at the same price level, they're going to buy a 30-year-old airplane.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Well, you also understand that airplane inside and out. You become the repairman of that airplane. You'll get a repairman certificate in the U.S. for that airplane, which allows you to do all your maintenance and inspections, any changes you want to make. All that stuff is actually under your control, which that makes that very appealing as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I can really relate to that. I mean, I've done several things over the years motivated because I want to learn how they work and like to be under control. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started podcasting, because I was curious to see, well, how the heck does podcast work? You know, how does all this stuff come together? So the best way to figure it out is to try it. And I can imagine it being the same thing here for many people who really want to be intimately involved with their aircraft and really understand it completely. It makes a lot of sense. Well, what about the social aspect? Are Kit Fox owners organized in any way? Are there events? What does that space look like?
I'm glad you asked that, because the Kit Fox community is a community that is very unique, and it brings a very unique person together. It's almost eerie, the people that it brings together as a cohesive unit. As far as the community. There's we have a builders base forum, for example. We have our factory fly-ins. There's a group out of Arizona called the Desert Fox Squadron. Been around for since 2000 is when they introduced themselves, and they actually have a motto: they don't leave anybody stranded. You call for help, they're coming to help you. It's a really unique group, eclectic people from all walks of life. We have a rancher out of Elko, Nevada, to multimillionaires, to
Walmart greeters.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the board, and yet you would never know it when you walk up to them. It's just fun. We've got guys that have made several trips to Alaska in their airplanes as a group. It's one of those things that you wish you could bottle up and sell, because there's no way to market it from a company standpoint. You have to experience it.
I think people that share some common interest tend to band together or form, you know, social relationships. But I have to say that across all the different interest groups, I'll say that I've seen over the years, aviation people just have an amazing affinity for that kind of social culture, social interaction. I mean, aviation people are great people. They love other aviation people, just love aviation, and it's just a wonderful community.
Well, they're all having fun. I think that's the key common denominator.
Yeah. Now, John, we were talking a little bit before we started about the new logo for Kit Fox. Why did Kit Fox decide to take a look at a new logo?
Mainly the times. Again, I mentioned, you know, Kit Fox was introduced in 1984. The logo has endured that time. It's a very popular logo. It's felt very well recognized. However, it did have an appearance of being more cartoonish. And we thought it was kind of 70s dated, if you want to put that word to it. With that in mind, we started looking at evolving the new logo. We started that several years ago. And the primary mission to do the new logo was to actually get a logo that's more representative of the airplane that we have today. Something that's a little bit more aggressive, more modern, for lack of better ways to put it.
To be taken seriously.
Yeah, to be taken seriously.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful design. I mean, I think it's thoroughly modern, and it just sort of evokes a good impression of what the company is all about. So I think it looks like a great success. Sometimes changing logos can be a little bit risky for a company, and sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't. But I think Kit Fox really has. Tell us the origin of the name Kit Fox. What's the story behind that?
Well, if you're into animals at all, you'll learn that the Kit Fox is actually a species of fox that is native to the southwestern United States. That we also have them up here in Idaho, in the southwest corner of Idaho. When Dan Denny and Dean Wilson started this aircraft, and Dan Denny broke off as Kit Fox and introduced in 1984, the name came about. There was a den of Kit Foxes that was actually near the airport. And being a play on words, being as it was a kit airplane as well, it just worked. And that's what worked it into the logo. The original Kit Fox was Denny Aerocraft, or, you know, Kit Fox by Denny Aerocraft. And it had the picture of the Kit Fox on it.
I see. Brandon, what's it like to work for this guy here? You love your job? I know you must love your job.
Do you want me to leave?
I do love my job. You know, it's hard to call it coming to work, because we get to play with airplanes every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we goof around when it's time, but even the work we do is a lot of fun. The ability to help people's dreams come true is a lot of fun. When people come pick up their kits at the factory here, and they're excited and they're energetic, you know, that all transfers to us as a job well done.
Did you have a big interest in aviation before you started working with the company, or was that something that kind of blossomed after you arrived at Kit Fox?
No, I've been an aviation nut before I could speak. I was pointing out airplanes, you know, and that's a great story my mom tells. And I've flown RC airplanes since I was 12 years old. Ah. Got hot and heavy into the competition side of RC airplanes, and John and I crossed paths and decided that we could make a relationship work, and we gave it a go. With no previous airplane building experience, and have an excellent training program here that brought me up to speed very quickly. and you know, allowed me to fulfill that dream of working in aviation.
That's great. That's fantastic. I love it when there's a story like that, something comes together. I won't ask you what you were doing before because, I don't know what the answer is.
It was totally legitimate, I promise, but it was not as fun as building airplanes. And when John originally offered me the job, I told him no. And I told my wife, I said, if he calls back, you know, a second time, then I'll probably take the job. And so he did call back a couple days later and said, you know, are you sure you won't reconsider? We're having lunch with my son. And I said, let me call you back in an hour. So we're driving down the road. My wife says, you know, how would you feel about driving to Homedale every day to build airplanes? And I said, well, you've seen that Geico commercial where the pig hangs out the window with the pinwheels and he's going, wee, wee. I said, that's pretty much how it would be like. Yeah. Just call him back and take the job.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's how many employees at Kit Fox?
We have 10.
Okay, so it's a nice compact family, probably a close-knit group.
A very close-knit group. We do have a lot of fun. Deborah and I try to keep it as a very a family-run type business. We enjoy that. We enjoy the camaraderie not only with our employees but also with our customer base, and that's important to us. I think Brandon nailed on something here earlier is one of the things that makes this so exciting is to make people's dreams a reality. And then you get to see that dream take flight. Hmm. It's really satisfying.
All right. Tell our listeners where they can learn more about Kit Fox or where they can find Kit Fox online, in social media, all of those sorts of things.
We've worked incredibly hard to stay current on social media type things. So we have kitfoxaircraft.com is our website. And there's all the information anybody could want about the product, the different models we offer. And, you know, references to pictures and videos and that kind of thing. We have a YouTube channel, which is Kit Fox Aircraft. And our Facebook is probably where we do the most updating as far as, you know, pictures and what's happening and things like that. Last year when we flew into Oshkosh, we did a live Facebook Live video of the arrival in Oshkosh in a Kit Fox.
Oh.
And so that was pretty cool. And then we shot a 360-degree video from inside the cockpit, and we posted that on YouTube. So there's some unique things there that people can kind of see from inside of a Kit Fox.
Brandon, what were you thinking as you were flying into Oshkosh? What was going through your head?
Don't screw this up.
There are a lot of eyes on that, right?
You do. We always fly in as a group. And so the factory takes usually 3 to 4 airplanes. And so naturally, to be polite, they let me go first that first time so they could make fun of me later. But, you know, you've read the NOTAM, you've watched other videos, you've heard the stories, and you're just almost terrified. And yet it all went very smoothly. I was well prepared. I had people with me that weren't going to let me go too far astray. And it was just a tremendous experience. And to arrive there and to see all the airplanes and see the big runways and see all the dots that you've heard about, you know, that you land on and all that kind of thing. It's surreal. It's absolutely surreal.
I'd like to interject on something on that, too. The controllers that handle Oshkosh and the organizers and the volunteers, what a bang-up job.
Yeah.
And those guys deal with thousands of people, not all of them polite, and they do a fabulous job with it. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah. No, it is an amazing thing. Yeah, for sure. All right. John McBean, Brandon Peterson, thanks so much for talking to us and our audience here on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thanks for the invite. Appreciate visiting with you. On a passing note, if you don't mind me real quick, what I'd like to encourage a lot of the listeners to do if they're shopping for an experimental or a home-built type airplane, just do your homework. There's a lot of opportunity out there. There's a lot of different airplanes out there. Find out what your mission statement is. And if you're real curious, come by our booth. I'm not trying to put a segue specifically to Kit Fox, but we have a checklist that we like to hand out to some people that kind of walks them through some of the questions they can ask their potential kit purchase, whether it be us. I hope it is a Kit Fox, but anybody, make sure you get good equipment and good stuff under you.
Great advice. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Max.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question, and I alluded to it in the opening about the wing.
Okay.
So in prepping for the show, I watched a few YouTube videos and saw a lot of Kit Fox in a Box. And it was really interesting watching the plane get rolled out of a trailer and then the wings folding out and watching people insert a pin to hold the wing in place. And I was just amazed by that. And I was just wondering, again, going back to a structural thing, is that really enough? Although I was at the Airbus factory and I was surprised to see that a A320's wing is held on by three bolts. So I don't know why I'm so amazed that this would be held on by one, but I am.
It really does come down to the sum of the parts, Brian. So if you look at the way the Kit Fox is designed with the lift strut component, that ties into an I-beam, an extruded I-beam aluminum insert that goes in the side of the spar, and the rivets are all incorporated into that insert, and then the load is shared with the head rack of the fuselage, and those four pins go into that head rack. The way it all ties together makes it for a very, very strong assembly, similar to our flaperons. You know, if you take foam alone, it's not very strong. If you take 016 aluminum, it's not very strong. And yet you put that with an aluminum spar and some adhesive and all together, and you know, that thing will flex 3 feet in either direction without, you know, failing. And then you rely on, John mentioned, the safety factor of our airplane. In all the years, we've never had an in-flight structural failure. So I'm pretty confident in those pins.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me.
and it really is remarkable. But then again, think about a bridge built with toothpicks.
Right, yes. Yeah. If you assemble them in the right fashion, it can be incredibly strong.
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't run cars over them.
It's a pretty remarkable little airplane. If you guys ever get a chance to be in one, love to have you get a ride in one and get around a little bit. You would enjoy it anytime.
All right.
Well, and then I always ask, is there an Airplane Geeks discount for purchasing one?
Are you ready to put your order in now?
Yeah. the trial close question. Very good.
Yeah. Very good. Very good.
That was good.
That's somebody says, well, $5,000, buy it. And I said, I'll get you started. How'd you want to handle the balance?
Yeah. All right. Let's do a little What's Up with the Geeks. I just wanted to mention briefly, I stumbled across an air show this past weekend that David knows very well. In fact, David, you've been attending this for years, right? The Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II weekend at the Reading Regional Airport. We were driving by and saw a sign and said, wow, an air show. Let's go. And we did. So it's quite a show, isn't it, David?
It's not your normal air show. It takes place at Spatz Field, which is actually Reading Airport. But the airfield on the north side becomes, best way to describe it, is a World War II battlefield. There are lots and lots of reenactors, and the reenactors come in tents, and they're Germans and Italians and Americans and French, and there are reenactors from the home front, the USO, and there's radio shows, and people bring their 40s cars and their Sherman tanks, and oh, and then there's some airplanes, like Mustangs and Spitfires and B-29s and B-17s and B-24s. And, of course, this weekend, my boys were up there, the Skytypers, and their SNJs. So they fit right in, even though they're red, white, and blue. And they give rides in Texans. And what's really kind of unfortunate is Max has listened to interviews from that air show multiple years. Uh-oh. And he didn't realize it.
Yeah. Bad Max.
But he had a good time, though, didn't you?
Great time. And again, it was kind of a stumble upon sort of thing. So in the future, we'll have to do it and do it more properly and attend more. It's a 3-day event. I mean, it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we were just there.
It's very easy. It's very easy to remember when it occurs.
Okay.
It's the weekend closest to D-Day.
Oh, interesting.
June 6th.
Okay, makes sense. All right, speaking of World War II, our main man Micah sent in an article from the Press Herald, Midway Hero Honored 75 Years Later. This is kind of a nice story. This is about a statue that's being dedicated to C. Wade McCluskey Jr., who was a lieutenant commander in charge of the air squadron on the USS Enterprise when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The Enterprise, David, were all the aircraft carriers out at sea at the time?
They were, yes. Yeah.
So
that was the big failure of the Japanese, was all of the carriers were away, were not in port to be sunk. So
at some point after that, the Japanese were planning to attack Midway, but the naval code was broken. So we knew that that was their plan, but not where the ships were. So McCluskey and, you know, many others went out to try to find the fleet, and they, for a variety of reasons, it wasn't happening. They were low on fuel, and they had to make a decision. Do they return back to the aircraft carriers, or do they continue the search knowing that they wouldn't have enough fuel? They ended up finding the aircraft carriers. They actually sank, I think, was it three of the aircraft carriers, damaged another. McCluskey himself got back to the carrier with 5 gallons of fuel in the tank. Others, according to this story, had less than that. And 10 planes actually had to ditch, and their crews were never found. So the hometown of McCluskey, Buffalo, New York, is erecting the statue in his honor. And I just think that there are so many examples from World War II, as well as other wars, of, you know, amazing acts of heroism and that sort of thing. And here we are all these years later, and it's still enough in people's minds to give recognition to that. So I think that's kind of a remarkable thing. All right, let's see. Max West, you've been doing some flying lately, as always.
Yes. In fact, I returned here just for this podcast show. No, it's not quite the case. Yeah, I had great fun last week. One of our podcast listeners, Rick, had contacted me and said, hey, can you come out to Kansas and fly a SR-20 that I've just bought back to Albany with me? So on just a few days' notice, I agreed to do that. We had a great flight. We made it in one day. And we had super tailwinds the whole way, which really helped. We were doing about 165 knots on average the whole time with an airplane that does 140 knots. So that was fun. And I'm going to do it all over again this week. So I'm headed out to Denver to fly with somebody up to, Salt Lake City. We'll be training that person in the aircraft, and then headed out to Williamsport, Pennsylvania to be teaching at a Cirrus pilot proficiency program for the weekend, and then flying from there to El Paso to pick up a Cessna 206 to fly with its owner back to California. So it's just kind of odd that all these things have happened together. So anyway, when you hear me next, I'll probably be totally exhausted, but having a great time.
Yeah, that's a good way to be exhausted. Well, it seems like you're flying as much these days as Brian usually does on United.
Exactly. And how's it? The only trouble is I'm not accumulating miles.
Yeah, but you're having more fun, I think.
It's true.
Brian, your trip to Africa, that's starting to come together?
Yeah, talk about spending all those miles that I've accumulated and our great listeners. So, yeah, the trip's definitely coming together. And a few months ago, I made a mention on the show that I was going to be going to South Africa, and one of our listeners said, hey, I live in South Africa. Why don't you come to my game reserve and see some animals? And I thought that was great. So Francois invited me out to his place. Now, I do not speak Afrikaans, so I'm going to butcher the name, but it's Thaba Tholo, I believe. And again, I apologize for mispronouncing that, and hopefully when I come back, I'll be able to actually pronounce it accurately. But I'm really looking forward to the game preserve. And they did a really neat thing not too long ago in that they introduced some black rhino back into the wild in Botswana. So in addition to being a game reserve, they have a breeding program and do a whole bunch of neat stuff. And Francois owns a 182 and hope to meet him in Johannesburg and fly out to the game reserve and spend a few days there. And yeah, really, really looking forward to it and super excited.
That sounds great. That's going to be a great trip. All right. A few weeks ago, we were talking about hand propping engines. And we had some conversation about that, but just today, in fact, we received a recording from our listener, Keith Shaddocks, He said that he's a docent at the Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum, and so he gets to talk about airplanes a lot, of course. He also says, I enjoy listening to you folks a great deal. He said, my drive from my house to the museum is filled with Airplane Geeks podcast, as well as Max Trescott's new podcast. Good for you, Keith. He says, great stuff for a retired guy who needs a break from the current general news. So don't we all keep it coming, he says. And then on the props, I hope you find the enclosed interesting. Never know when I am too far into the weeds, but I think I have kept this light enough. Now, he says, there are some folks that just don't understand the hold this thing with wings has on us. See you on the ramp, or I will wave at you in the run-up area. So here's Keith's recording about hand propping. This is really interesting. Give this a listen.
Hello, my name is Keith Shavix, and I've been a listener of the Airplane Geeks podcast for about 4 years now. I enjoy it very much, and I am especially intrigued by all of the different folks that have appeared on the show and the many different voices we get to hear. But more than anything else, like all of you, I am myself an airplane geek. My reason for sending this in is to perhaps add something to the conversation about the subject of pulling a radial engine through before starting it, and also the actual subject of the question that was posed by the listener about hand propping the airplane in the movies. I am sure that there are others out there that can speak with more authority on this than me, but in the interest of keeping the conversation interesting, I thought I would see if I can clarify a little on the subject. First of all, in full disclosure, I should let you know that I am a private pilot flying out of Centennial Airport in suburban Denver, Colorado. I also hold an A&P and that I've not kept active in recent years. I'm also a docent at the Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum in Denver. And of course, I encourage listeners as well as the geeks to visit the museum. We have quite an assortment of interesting aircraft, including a B-1A bomber and a very rare B-18. First, the topic of pulling a radial engine through before starting. This is always done if the engine has been setting for some time, such as overnight. The situation requiring this is that oil, and there is a lot of it involved with a radial engine, will always run down towards the lower cylinders of the engine. If one of the lower cylinders is stopped with the intake valve open, oil will run all the way into the cylinder, perhaps even filling it up. Then if the engine were to be cranked with a starter, the piston in that cylinder would come up on compression stroke with the valves closed. Since oil is a liquid and it is not compressible like air, you get what is known as a hydraulic lock. This could and probably would damage the engine, even bending the connecting rod going to that piston. So before the engine is cranked with a starter, the engine is pulled through by hand using the prop while the magnetos and fuel are shut off in a safe condition. It's always necessary to pull enough rotation so that each cylinder passes through a compression stroke. If during the pull-through you feel one of the pistons coming up on hydraulic lock, you try to move the prop very slowly so as to squeeze the oil past the piston rings. And if this doesn't work, it may be necessary to pull the lower spark plug out of the cylinder to actually let the oil run out as the engine is pulled through. The plug then can be reinstalled to crank the engine with a starter for starting. I'm not an expert on this, but I thought my limited experience with this might be clarifying. Now to the topic of hand propping an engine for starting. This is something that I have never done and certainly don't recommend. There are folks out there, however, that have extensive experience hand propping small aircraft that don't have electrical systems, such as the basic Piper Cub. However, the old biplanes of yesteryear were certainly hand-propped. The question concerned is seen from the movie The Great Waldo Pepper. Now, I have a nice collection of aviation books that I inherited from my dad, who passed away in 2004. He was a pilot in World War II and had a lifelong love of all things aviation. In this collection is a book by a man named Frank Tallman, who was a test pilot and stunt pilot. Tallman, along with another pilot named Paul Mance, formed a company in Hollywood called Tall Mance Aviation. The sole purpose of the company was to supply aircraft and expert stunt flying for the movies during the 1960s and 70s. I'm not sure if Tall Mance was involved with the great Waldo Pepper, but they were certainly involved with the Spirit of St. Louis movie as well as many others. The book by Tallman is titled Flying the Old Planes. And in the book, Tallman says that the airplane of choice for biplane scenes was always the Standard. This was a large biplane that looked something like the Curtis Jenny. The Standard was built originally by the Standard Aircraft Company of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and then later out of Nebraska somewhere, I believe, Lincoln, I think. So, and at that time, it was then called the Lincoln Standard. The Standard was the aircraft of choice because it had a much more reliable and a more powerful power plant than the one that was in the Jenny that everyone thinks about in the golden age of barnstorming. Now, they were both powered by water-cooled engines, but the Jenny was powered by the cantankerous and rattle-trap Curtis OX-5, where the Standard was powered by the Wright-built Hispano Suizer, or Suizer or Suizer, however you pronounce it. This engine was always called the Hissel, and it was very likely the engine seen in the movie The Great Waldo Pepper. Now, I'm going to take the liberty of quoting from Tallman's book about starting the Standard with the Hissel engine, because it clearly defines exactly what the listener saw. And I quote, "Stepping up for the first time to the massive wooden meat cleaver of a propeller on the front of the Standard would turn most any present-day mechanic's knees to jelly. Actually, once the prop was rocked back and forth to load the Hissel and the carburetor indicates slight overflow, it is ridiculously easy to start. The mechanic grabs the bottom of the prop and kicks it a half swing backward against compression. The pilot spins the booster mag like a whirling dervish, and with a satisfied chuff, 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 the Hissel starts and settles down into an idle so smooth and so slow that you can nearly count the blades passing." End of quote. So, as you can see, what he saw in the movies was exactly what happened. And in fact, that's how you started a Hissel. I hope that handles a little bit of clarification on these two subjects, and I enjoyed sending it in, and I will enjoy hearing more stuff on the Airplane Geeks podcast. So I'll talk to you later.
Oh, thanks, Keith. That was really fascinating. Really, really well done. I can really visualize what's happening here.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's possible or would have been possible to put some sort of valve or plug or something that would allow the easy exit of the oil instead of going through all that stuff. But I don't know, I guess putting a plug in a cylinder under such compression, maybe that's not such a good idea. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it might have been an issue that they tried to address or to look at and just didn't have a solution for it, an engineering solution. But I tell you, when I was up over this weekend at the air show, walking around some B-25s and the pools of oil underneath those engines was yep. was really, really something. So, but again, thanks, Keith, for sending that in. Very much appreciated. We love getting listener recordings. If you've got a topic that you'd like to talk about, answer a question or pose one, please feel free to send us a recording. And in fact, all of you guys over at KitFox there listening to this, over the PA system or over the speaker system, if any of you guys want to put together a little recording, any aviation subject, we'd love to hear from you. So, send that in.
We'll be more certain I have help to do that.
Yeah. One quick shout out. Boy, we've been talking about air shows a lot lately over the last few episodes, of course, about the Pittsburgh Air Show. I just wanted to mention that Jennifer – Jennifer Adams, who was our guest back in episode 404. She, of course, writes the Tales from the Terminal blog, and she had a post in there from a couple of weeks ago describing the event from her perspective that I thought was really good. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. She spent some time describing the F-22, and to quote from her post, she says, the F-22 is powered by two Pratt & Whitney F-119 turbofan engines, which have nozzles that incorporate 2D thrust vectoring. She writes, I have no idea what any of that means. What it does, however, is allow the Raptor to fly in ways that are, frankly, ridiculous. So if you are unaware of what thrust vectoring nozzles are like, I just poked around for a few minutes on YouTube and found a video. We'll put that in the show notes. That it's got kind of a close-up of the nozzles on the F-22 engines being sort of exercised before the plane takes off. So it gives you a good look at just what that thrust vectoring nozzle is like. All right, moving on to listener mail. Some of the items we received concerned the report that we had a few weeks ago, I guess, about Alan Joyce being hit in the pie with a face. About Alan Joyce being hit in the face with a pie. And Brent sent us some comments, also Mark Newton and Rob as well. And apparently the guy that was the pie thrower, as Mark Newton put it, was an anti-gay activist who objected to Alan Joyce's homosexuality and the fact that Qantas, under his leadership, has come out as a supporter of marriage equality legislation in Australia, which is kind of a hot topic in Australia these days. Rob also wrote in describing how Alan Joyce was at a breakfast meeting of the Australian Marriage Equality Group. He says also attending were the CEOs of several large businesses and organizations, including the TV network SBS, Carnival Cruises, the City of Sydney, St. Vincent's Hospital, Virgin Mobile, the Bank St. George, as well as representatives from organizations like Google, American Express, Deloitte, and others. He said, understandably, Mr. Joyce spoke in favor of marriage equality. So the guy that threw the pie that we talked about was arrested. He's been charged with this, but I think it still remains an open issue. But we asked you to help us understand what was happening here, and want to thank the listeners for you who wrote in to explain it to us. So we appreciate it. Nigel wrote in, says, chaps, I'm sure someone else will have flagged this up to you. The question is, should we welcome this or be afraid? And he sent a link to an article from This Week in FM that's concerning controllers at LCY being asked in the Swanwick and Root Center, some 60 miles away. He says, in the U.S., could all airports be controlled from FAA headquarters in the future? And what the article describes is that London City Airport is going to become the first airport in the UK to install this digital air traffic control tower, which is supposed to go operational in 2019. And this makes me think, John, of what you were saying before about automation. But this digital solution uses 360-degree HD cameras and sensors on a new tower, and it provides all this feedback remotely to the building where the air traffic control function is taking place. So I think we do, Maxie, don't we have some towers that actually kind of work like this in the U.S. where the air traffic control is not at the tower itself?
Yes, Leesburg, Virginia is a test site. I don't know that there are any sites that are fully deployed here in the U.S., but that's the one test site I know of. And I was just kind of mulling this and thinking, what's the huge cost advantage? You would think that most of these automations would reduce the number of people that are involved, but holy cow, you know, I look at my tower, and I don't see any extra people sitting around up there. It's a very busy tower. The only thing I can guess is that maybe it's more efficient to have people all overlapping so that when somebody's on break, somebody else can cover your tower position. So I think the real economies would come after you start having more than one tower automated. You're going to have some overlapping of staff between them.
Yeah, and we've had some issues in the past. We've seen some items in the news where at, I call it very quiet tower, towers with very little activity, the controller's falling asleep or that kind of issue, or stepping out sometimes. I think there was one that went out to get a pizza or something, and that causing obvious problems. So, if you have a central air traffic control function, maybe it's a way to address that problem, at least for really low-volume towers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think if you were to control a bunch of low-volume towers from one place, you could probably get some efficiencies there with hardly any disruption to safety. But, frankly, most towered airports are, by definition, not low-volume because that's where they put the towers.
That's where they have a tower.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for fear of having David yell at me, I could say they could all be controlled from Trump Tower.
Yeah, I know. we've had several reactions. Okay. Last one from Eric. This came in from LinkedIn. He said, I wanted to quickly share a link the GE marketing folks put together from the GE 9X engineering icing campaign earlier this year. And it's a video on YouTube, GE 9X, the world's biggest fan of ice. That's sort of a little play on words there. This was just published. This is kind of spectacular, at least for, engine guys like me, because you want to test jet engines, obviously, for icing conditions. And one way to do that is to put one on a test stand and throw a lot of ice at it. And that's kind of what's happening here. So it's kind of dramatic. The GE 9X, of course, is the engine that's being developed for the Boeing 777X. And this is a big, big engine, 105 pounds of thrust, huge fan diameter, 132-inch fan diameter. That is a really, really large large engine. And GE has got their first test engine, which is the one they used for this recent ice test. Building,
and,
I think.
And how about 105,000 pounds of thrust, not 105,000, 105.
What did I say?
105 pounds of thrust.
Yeah, that won't get you too far. That'd be kind of small for a kit fox, wouldn't it? What do we see for engines on kit foxes?
Kind of the engine of choice is the Rotax family, the 9 series, 912, 912IS, 914 turbo, and the recently arrived 915. But we actually support 14 different engine options for the kit fox, whether it's Lycoming, Continental, Titan, Viking. The radial engine by Rotec has been really, really popular. And so there's a lot of different options there.
Do you have to hand prop any of those?
Actually, the radial, you could. It was funny you were saying that because we talked about why somebody hasn't put a plug. They did put a plug. It's called a spark plug, Brian. At the bottom of the cylinder.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
This has been a good night.
Yeah. And by the way, I think 105 pounds of thrust, that would make our RC planes go pretty well.
Yeah, it would.
That'll do it.
That would.
Yep. A good quadcopter with that much thrust would do wonders.
I think so. All right. Well, listen, I think we better put a fork in this one. We want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guests this episode were John McBean and Brandon Peterson from Kit Fox Aircraft. KitFoxAircraft.com is the website. John and Brandon, thanks again for joining us on the show.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate your allowing us on the show.
Thank you much.
All right. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to visit the show notes, you can go straight to them. That's airplanegeeks.com/455. Look on our webpage for links to where you can find us on social media, how to contact us, and all that. Let's tell our listeners where they can find us online. Max Trescott, start with you. Where do people find more Trescott?
Well, they can come out to aviationnewstalk.com, and the listener survey is up this week, so that's kind of fun seeing what people have to say. And if you want to fly with me, just go to sjflight.com, short for San Jose Flight.com.
And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, since I'm still not being social on social media, the best place to get hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com. And just want to follow up with my last thing. If anyone is in South Africa and wants to get together, please let me know. Send me an email. And yeah, look forward to getting together in South Africa.
Cool. We have listeners in, I think the last time I checked it was, well, I can't remember how many countries, but it's more than 50. There's listeners in just about every country in the world almost, which is kind of cool. So there must be some more folks in South Africa.
Yep.
That can, well, of course, they might be in South Africa, but whether or not they want to see you is maybe a different issue.
That I completely understand.
So anyway, sorry, but that was an easy one. But David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And of course, you can find me talking UAVs with that guy, Max Flight, on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at PAXXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. That's PAXEXPodcast.com. Also on the Airplane Geeks Slack listener team. Be sure to check that out. Learn more at airplanegeeks.com/team. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.